All right, welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artists. And our artist this week is Lizzie Pye from Laura Lynn Embroidery and Needlework. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi.
Thanks.
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm all right. Thanks for joining us. Looking forward to this.
Welcome. And me too.
Yes. So we have a recording here on a Monday afternoon with Lizzie's toddler son off with the grandparents. So a moment of peace and quiet.
Yep. Very rare in this house.
Yes. Yeah. Raised a couple myself. I know all about that peace and quiet, that rare peace and quiet time. Yes.
Oh, yes. Yep. I relish it. He keeps me very busy.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. You had me at Royal School of Needlework. I am always fascinated with anyone who has gone through their program, and you went through the big program, right?
Yes, the apprenticeship. I was one of the last apprentices, actually, because the apprenticeship program finished in 2009, so that's when I graduated.
Oh,
yeah.
The last, so there's not been an apprentice since then.
No. They now have a wonderful program, the Future Tutor program, which is a little different. It's a lot of the same kind of thing, but it's structured a little differently. And where we were paid, sort of, for our time there, we did the whole year, day in, day out, you know, your standard holiday thing. But we didn't get the nice breaks like you do at university and all of that. And we worked in the studio and that kind of thing. And the Future Tutor program is structured a little differently. So it began a bit more like a university program. So they would do the terms in the same way, and a bit less studio time. But now they actually, they're bringing it more back to how it was when I was learning. So they do a bit more studio time, which is the kind of conservation, restoration side of things. So that's quite interesting.
So when you went through it, then you got full metal. So you got everything, was to do with needlework.
Yep. Some of it we did multiple times.
Yeah.
Yep.
I assume, although enjoyable, pretty grueling, long days, long weeks.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, big time. It was full on. I was lucky. I didn't have to do any paid work alongside. I know a couple of people who did. And I honestly do not know how they did it. I was burnt out. But, you know, as you say, really enjoyable. I kind of miss it in a weird sort of way.
Yeah.
I don't miss that hard work, but I do miss just being able to be creating stuff all the time and at such a level as well. And I was really, really lucky. I lived with another of the apprentices at the time. My best friend is Helen Richman, who runs Bluebird Embroidery. You may have come across her on the web.
Yes, I've heard the name.
A lot of your listeners will have done. And she's brilliant. But the great thing was we lived together while we did the apprenticeship. We met on our interview day, and I was like, oh, well, if we both get on the course, we can, you know, maybe we can live together. Just thinking, oh, with that, you know, this will never happen. We'll probably never meet again. Like, I won't get on it. It'll be fine. And then we did both get on it, and we were like, oh, well, okay, well, let's live together. So we did. And we are still best friends now. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun, and she kind of kept me going. And through the tough times,
yeah,
like black work, my fellow apprentices remember me running off and crying in the bathroom about black work.
not your deal, huh?
Well, I love it. I love them all, to be honest. But black work, I really struggled with it. It was the one that everyone had that moment at some point. And for me, it was black work.
I think that's an interesting thing to go through a program like that, because you enter the program and obviously have a deep interest, if not a love, for needlework.
Mm.
But then after you go through something that intense, there's a risk that at the end you'll just hate it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for some people who went through the apprenticeship in the past, I mean, I know quite a lot of people who did it who, you know, I've never met because they're not in embroidery anymore.
Yeah.
You know, they did the course and maybe they did a little bit and then they've kind of, you know, gone and done something else. I think nursing seems to be a really popular one.
Oh, okay.
There's a bit of a link there.
Probably pays better too.
It didn't do that for me. I was still very much in love with it when I left.
Yeah. Well, and see that, yeah, that's, there is that risk. I mean, it's, You either intensify your love for it or say, no, I'm done. I'm out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I was a bit like that with sort of academic stuff. I was, as a kid, I was, well, I'm a complete geek, nerd, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was really academic. I always did the arty stuff as well, but I was really academic. And I got to the end of my GCSEs. So I don't know how that compares with your structure over there, but kind of middle of high school, I guess.
Okay.
And I just kind of went, oh, I'm so done with this. And yeah, and I kind of went, okay, so I'm going to go do something different. And I applied for universities to do a different creative stuff, so like costume and fashion design, that kind of thing. And actually when I went for the RSM program, I was signed up to do fashion design and computer aided design.
Oh.
Which, yeah, I would have probably been quite good at the computer stuff, to be fair, but just would have hated it. So not my bag. I would have really been bad at it. And I am so glad that I just kind of bumped into the RSN and went, oh, right, that's it then. That's for me. Here we go.
Yeah. Now it's interesting to me because so then you really have had an orientation toward some textile thing your entire life then.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. My granny taught me knitting. Was probably the first thing I did. And I reckon I was about 3 when she started me off. I mean, you know, we're not talking anything fancy, but just little bits here and there. And I did a little bit of sewing. I did loads of cross stitch. I still would do cross stitch if I ever had time.
Yeah.
And I did a load of needlepoint. And then when I was doing my A-levels, I did a big essay. There's like during your A-levels here, you do a really big essay on a topic and you basically pick your own topic. It can be anything in the art world. And you have to write it's like a dissertation kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I went, I'm going to do, I don't know, the history of embroidery.
Well, that narrows it down.
I was like, I can just totally write an essay about the history of embroidery. That's fine. I can cover it all in an essay. Yeah. But I did get a very good grade.
I'm sure.
Yeah, that kind of kickstarted me and I did loads of different stuff and like beadwork and I kind of discovered some of the more sort of detailed techniques. I kind of, when I went into it, I was like, oh, well, embroidery is just, you know, a few stitches on some fabric and, you know, there's a couple of different things and there's quilting and whatever. And then I kind of fell down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And was like, oh, there's this and there's this and there's this and oh my God, I could do all kinds of stuff with this. And yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of the hidden agendas for teachers that assign projects like that.
Yeah.
is because it hits you as a student, like, oh geez, I got to write a paper. I got to do some research. But then there's that, you don't realize that, I don't think till later, that the hidden agenda is it opens your eyes and expands your horizons. If you make even a minimal effort, and yeah, you start to discover things you had no idea existed.
Yeah. Yeah. Big time. And I discovered as well that I could write, which was kind of a thing for me. Cause I got good grades at school, but I always really struggled with expressing myself in words. So for me, it was like, oh, I can write. I just can't write creative stuff. Like I can't make up a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I still can't, and my 2-year-old would tell you this too, if he could talk. I can't make up a story. I'm useless at that. But give me something with facts to write about and I can write.
Mm-hmm.
And I think writing that essay was kind of like, oh, I can actually, you know, write stuff, which was a big deal. Because then when it came, you know, later down the line and I was asked to write things, it was like, oh, well, yeah, okay. I might be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something as a magazine editor that people just don't understand is that there are very different skill sets for, say, a creative writer, a fiction writer, and a nonfiction writer, and then an editor, because it's always assumed that editors are good writers. And that's not always the case, because it's not what we do.
And, no, funnily enough, I'd probably be a better editor than I am a writer.
Yes.
But... that's because I'm super picky.
Right. Well, but that's just it. That's just it. And they're very different skill sets, yet for people who have never done it, it all gets lumped into writer. And so you discover, hey, if you give me some facts, I can put them together and make them flow and make sense and tell a little bit of a story. And you make me make up a story about a murder plot, and I can't do it.
I wouldn't have a clue.
Right. Yeah.
No, that's not me.
Right.
Sometimes I tell people, you know, I wrote a book, people that don't know me very well. And I don't generally bring it up, but sometimes my husband will go, oh, by the way, she wrote a book. And I'm like, oh,
here we go.
And people kind of go, oh my God, you wrote a book. What's it about? And it's like, you know, no, I didn't write a fiction book.
Right.
I didn't write a novel that you're going to go read at some whodunit or something. No. I wrote an embroidery book. It's different.
Oh, that. Okay.
Yeah. Whole different skill.
Right. Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, but that's great that you were able to discover that. And to know that you can communicate with a written word and not actually be afraid of it, because so many people are afraid of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite a confidence boost.
Yes. So you started. Your grandmother taught you to knit. Have you done needlework all the way through your life at one time or another? I mean, I'm sure there are gaps, but. Has it been pretty much something, a part of your life from that age 3?
Yeah. You know, I honestly don't think there are any gaps.
Oh, that's impressive.
Yeah. We've got a way to go yet. But I mean, I started when I was very young and I did this little bit of knitting and I did the kind of stuff on Binker, and I did, you know, the plastic canvas. I used to make boxes of plastic canvas, so I'd make like a design on each side and then stitch them together into a box with a lid. That was a lot of fun. And you know, I was quite little at this point. I was probably like 6 maybe when I was doing that, and then I would do cross stitch and I would do all these other things. And I used to make toys as well. I used to there was a company that did little fluffy toys years ago. And I had all of their little fluffy animals and stuff that I had made. And then I was like, well, that's kind of boring. And, you know, I'm bored of making their squirrel. I'm going to make my own creatures. So I invented like a little frog and has a weird kind of cat thing with embroidered eyes. I played a lot with stuff like that, and I did it all through school because I went to a boarding school and I really didn't fit in. And I kind of, one of the reasons I didn't fit in was because I did sewing, and I loved sewing, and it kind of stuck with me. It was one of those things, if you didn't fit in and you were kind of on your own a lot, sewing actually was a pretty good hobby to have. So I just kept it going. And then eventually I guess my textiles teacher was like, she was this amazing woman. She must have been past retirement age, I think, when she was teaching me. And she had this little kind of peak in her eyebrow. And she would peer over her little glasses at you. And just, everyone thought she was really strict, but she really got me. And so I would go to this kind of textiles club thing, which was basically like nobody. It was enforced. So there were like maybe 5 of us. And I was the only one enjoying it. But she would help me with stuff. Yeah.
A teacher, five of you, and only one's happy. That's a good picture.
Yep. It was just, it was that kind of time. I mean, when was that? I guess that was like late 90s, early 2000s. And it wasn't cool. Like, it just wasn't cool, especially for a teenager.
Yeah.
So everyone else was like, no, I'm too cool for this. And I was kind of like, well, I'm not cool anyway, so here we go.
There's your out right there. You're not cool, so who cares?
Exactly. It really didn't matter. So I kept it going. I remember I would knit like scarves and stuff for my friends, and I would make little toys for them. I remember making a little frog for an ex-boyfriend when I was like 15, 16. Yeah, just kind of kept it going the whole time.
That's impressive, because I think for most people in those years, there's so many other things you want to explore that you know, needlework just goes away and then comes back later after you get married or have kids or any number of things. And
it's sort of, I think I'm the exception that proves the rule.
Well, and I, you know, I've said this many times, and I'm a firm believer that getting exposed to, whether it's needlework or cooking or sewing at a young age, and then if you don't, you do nothing with it, but how many people in their adult lives after they've raised kids then pick that stuff up, and if they had never been exposed to it, would probably never you know, think about it. And so,
exactly. You know, it's actually really sad when you meet people who...
Yeah.
It's kind of a bit of a generational thing. Like, my mum does actually sew and that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of people of her sort of age who didn't pick it up from their parents for whatever reason, because the world was changing a lot very fast at that sort of time. And I guess it just, people were like, well, we're not going to have to do this anymore, so why do we teach it to our kids?
Right.
And yeah, you sort of think there's a lot of people now who are their children who haven't got a clue where to start. And it's actually really sad.
Yes.
But the good news is that a lot of those people are now like, well, actually, hang on a minute. This is kind of fun stuff, actually. Like, I could enjoy cooking and sewing and things. You know, it doesn't have to be about need. It can be about enjoying it. So it kind of, I guess it's coming back round again.
Yeah, and it is. And, you know, the TV, all the Food Network cooking shows have facilitated a whole world of that. And yeah,
and we have the sewing bee over here.
So you have a sewing show. Okay.
We have a sewing show. I don't know if it's on this year, but there's been a couple of years at least of sewing show. It's the Sewing Bee. I watched the first series and it makes me twitchy, so I don't watch it. But if you are not already in and you kind of know what you're talking about, it's a very good way in.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kirsty Allsop, with all of her kind of making stuff, she goes to meet all different makers, and a lot of people don't really like her, but I kind of think she's great, because actually she's introducing people who wouldn't normally be interested.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, well, it's fine if you know, preach the converted. That it's not going to get anyone new in. It's not going to get anyone younger in.
Yeah.
If you're just talking to people who already love it.
Right.
You know, it's great to talk to people who already love it. It's brilliant. But you also need to kind of push it out there a little bit.
Yeah, you
and
do.
That's what kind of TV shows and stuff really do.
Yeah. Well, and that this whole world, this electronic world we live in, allows people to do that. I mean, you just look at the cross-stitch world these days is just on fire. And what's behind all of that is the internet and sharing videos. And there are just so many ways for young people to get involved, and it's paying off. And
things have changed so much.
Yeah.
And just the kind of the access to information and all these things that, you know, when I was a kid, it was, well, that's not cool, so nobody knows about it, so it kind of just dies.
Right.
Whereas now, there's always someone out there who knows about it.
Well,
and
it, but
you can go fight those people.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's the thing, is it may not be cool in your little local sphere, but there's people, lots of people all over the world for whom it is cool, and now you can connect with them. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, and it crosses ages, and it crosses race and gender and everything else, and it's brilliant.
Yes.
You know, getting access to the information that is without all of those things and without your little insular world.
Yes.
Because let's face it, as a teenager, your world is pretty small.
Yes.
in the best possible way, and it in some ways it should be. But, you know, it's nice to have that way out to find other things, isn't it?
Yes.
Find other people like you. You are not alone.
Yep. That is so true. All right. So you met Jenny Aiden Christie, a wonderful woman, at a show.
She is.
And that was a turning point for you then.
That was a turning point because I had never heard of the Royal School of Needlework. And basically, I went along, it was a knitting and stitching show, and I can't remember what year it was. I want to say it was probably like 2003, 2004, right about then. And we went to the knitting and stitching shows, me and my parents, and we signed up for, I think it was either Goldberg or Stumpwork. There was a little strawberry Stumpwork thing that we did and a little swirly Goldberg thing. And I can't remember which one was which and which year and so on. But anyway, because they do these little 1 hour trial classes. And me and my dad went along. Mum went off and, I don't know, looked at knitting or something. And Dad came with me and we sat in this little group. And Jenny was the teacher. And she was, I think she was doing her apprenticeship at that point. And we sort of went through this little class and it was like an hour long and it was fine. And she came around and talked to everyone in her wonderful, gentle way that she does. And at some point in that, she went, "You should come and talk to me on the stand." And I was like, okay, I don't know where that is, but I'll, you know, yeah, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we went and found the RSN stand and I was just like, this is amazing. People are doing this. Like, this is a big thing. And my dad had a whole conversation with her about slate frames and trestles and stuff like that. And I was just sort of, I was probably 16, 17 at this point. So I was just sort of stood there going, oh my God, this is amazing. What is this all about? And also feeling slightly awkward and embarrassed because I was a teenager.
Right.
And a really socially awkward one at that. And we kind of, we kept talking and she was like, well, you know, if you're really interested in this, you should probably come on a class. And my dad went, oh yeah, let's do that. Right. Let's book on a class. So we went, my dad and I went and did a 2 day class with Jenny at the RSN. And I can remember exactly, but I teach in this room now myself, so I can remember exactly where we sat. And I still have the thing that we were doing. I've never finished it, but I have this project still. It was a passion flower and like different layers of fabric and silk shading and gold work. And it was way above my level at that point, but it was brilliant. And kind of sometime in that class, this 2 days, she went, I think you should probably apply for an apprenticeship. And I was like, sorry, what?
So like, she saw something there then.
Well, I think it was probably, if anything, it was the fact that I was obviously young, because I would have been the youngest in that class by quite a lot.
Yeah.
Probably like 40 years.
Oh, my.
Things have changed a bit since then, but, you know, this is a while back, and it was a bit like that back then. And, I guess she probably just thought, well, this is someone who is obviously interested, and she's young enough to be able to take this on. And because the apprenticeship, you did have to be kind of young enough. Now there's no restriction on it, but the apprenticeship, you did actually have to be, I think it was, I want to say it was under 25, maybe. Oh. So that kind of cut, obviously, quite a bit of the audience, as it were.
Yeah.
So it's all her fault.
So you literally went from that show to signing up for the apprenticeship program?
Within like a few months, yeah.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
That's a huge leap. Wow.
Yeah, and I was already, well, like I said, I was already kind of signed up to go to university at that point. So I kind of had to go, actually, I'm not coming. I'm going to go do this.
Oh, my. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a really kind of a big gamble.
That was exactly the word that was in my head. Wow, that is a yes, a gamble and a half.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, it was good, and my parents were pretty supportive for the whole thing. They did a lot of financial support, which was very much needed.
That does help.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you know, see, I'm not in debt now. You see, which is good because university tends to put people in a lot of debt. So, right. You know, I lived very frugally for 3 years, but I don't have a big debt hanging over my head. So It's good in that way too.
Oh yeah, it puts you ahead a lot of people. Yeah.
It's nice not to have that burden, I have to say.
Yeah. So then what were you, 16, 17 when you went to the Royal School then?
So I think I had just turned 18.
Mm.
Yeah, I get my timings very confused. I don't know how old I am now. but yeah, I was pretty young. So I was just out of college at that point.
That's interesting to me because that speaks to you as a person and self-discipline, because to go to an intense program like that at that age and to stick it out that's a huge, that's just that alone is a huge,
stubborn.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a huge accomplishment for anyone, but to do that at that age when it's so hard to keep focused.
Yeah, it was hard to keep focused at times. But you know, there started out seven of us, and then there were six. And there were three of us who were all that age. Hmm. So we'd all come out of college, and that kind of helped in a way, but also the fact that it was a mix, because we had three who were not a lot older, but you know, they worked and then they came to do this. And that kind of helped as well. It was kind of nice that there was a bit of a mixture.
Yeah.
I think if I'd been the only one who was really young, I might have struggled more.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think if we'd all been that young, it would have been really hard to learn the discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was a good mix.
Yeah, all of you that age, that would have just gone south. Yeah,
they could have really gone off the rails. I think they were thinking quite carefully about who they took on and what the mix would be. I mean, you know, I don't know. They never told us, but I feel like that was probably part of the thing of putting a year group together was, you know, how are these people going to work together,
mm-hmm.
as a group, and actually keep themselves going.
Right.
Because
right.
you didn't have the support.
Right.
It was just, you know, it was grueling. So you needed to be in a good group and for it not to be all infighting and nastiness, which, you know, when you get a bunch of women together is a thing that can happen. But yeah, no.
Well,
but
bunch of teenage girls. Yeah, that could have gone.
If we were all 18, it would have been much more volatile, I think. But we were all very nice people and very calm.
Well, that's good.
Mind you, our big day out of the week for me and Helen was to go to Sainsbury's, which is, if you don't know, is our superstore here. So, so this was like going to, I don't know, Walmart.
Oh, that was your big day out, was to go do that?
We couldn't afford to go out.
Oh, okay.
And we were very busy. We were working, like, because it was quite funny with Helen and I living together. I would get up really early like 4 or 5 in the morning, and I would stitch before we went into the RSN. So I'd do my like couple of hours, 3 hours, whatever it was. And then I'd have my breakfast, and then we'd like get up properly and go into work, and go learn. And then we would finish at 4 o'clock, and we'd come home absolutely drained. And we'd then kind of go back to doing some more stitching in the evening, and we would stitch together until like around 10 o'clock when I would just go, right, that's it. I can't do this anymore. Cause I just don't do after 10 o'clock at night. Yeah. I'm definitely a morning person. And Helen would then keep stitching, and there'd be times when she'd be stitching till like 2 in the morning. And yeah, it was pretty full on. And if you're doing that, you know, pretty much every day, you don't have time to go out.
Right.
I remember one of the Harry Potter films came out, and we're both big Harry Potter fans. And we went to see that together. And that was like the big thing of the whole year.
The whole year, yeah.
Because it was like, well, firstly, it was money that we didn't have. And it was like, we're actually going out to do something. It was, yeah. We were a little bit reclusive for 3 years, but yeah. we had each other. So it was just really nice, actually. We would just sit and stitch and chat, and yeah.
Well, a lot to be said for that. What happens to you physically going through a program like that and doing all of that needlework day after day? I mean, at some point, your neck and your arms and your hands and your fingers?
Yep. I am so glad that I did it when I was 18. Because if I did it now, it would probably kill me. I had to see a physiotherapist for a while. And I got myself one of those sit-kneel chairs where you kneel on the bottom bit and then you kind of perch. Yeah, they're kind of handy. Yeah, a lot of time hunched over, and a bit of a residual effect. And my eyes, I got glasses when I was about 16 for reading. And then kind of as the apprenticeship went on, I needed them all the time. Mm-hmm. And now I need them all the time, and they're a lot stronger. But yeah, actually, it was funny. The book I wrote on white work for the RSN, that was the one that really did my eyes an injury. Just purely because I was working white on white for about a year, and I didn't do very much else. So it just, that kind of intense work on white only did kind of increase my prescription somewhat. Yeah. But it's settled out again. I mean, I didn't recover, but it slowed down again after that. So luckily.
Well, yeah, and I think we're smarter these days about ergonomics, and you have to take breaks and all of those things. I mean, computers have forced us to get smarter.
Yes. Yeah, I have to say I am still really bad for taking breaks. I make my students take breaks. I'm very hot on that. You have to take breaks, because I'm not having it on my head that you do your back in. But but no, really, because, you know, you want people to be able to enjoy the whole day. If you're with someone for a whole day teaching them embroidery, you need them to take breaks because you want them to keep enjoying it.
Right.
But I have to admit that when it's me stitching at home or writing instructions or something, I just wrote some instructions yesterday, day before. Can't remember. Anyway, and it did kind of, you know, I sit there for like a couple of days, usually at least, writing instructions, doing diagrams, taking pictures, editing pictures, all of this kind of stuff. And I am hunched over my computer with my mouse, one shoulder up and one kind of like hanging. I always have my feet tucked under me, which is the worst possible position. I'm on a really cheap IKEA chair. Swivel chair with no armrests.
Oh, geez.
And I just think to myself, I am doing this wrong. And I know I am, but I just can't take breaks. I just forget. I get so involved that I just keep going.
So you have awareness of the problem, but you ignore it. Okay.
Yes. Yep. I am burying my head in the sand on this one.
Okay. All right. Well, as long as you know what you're doing to yourself, then, you know. Then,
yeah,
yeah.
I keep saying to myself, when I have a bit of money spare, which probably won't be for the foreseeable future, but when I do, I will get myself a better chair. And I am so desperate for a standing desk.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, because it's one thing with the stitching. You know, I've kind of, over the years, I've kind of got used to stitching in positions that do work and that aren't so bad for my back and that sort of thing. So stitching wise, I've kind of figured it out. And I don't do so much work these days that involves a slate frame. So I don't have the hunching over something flat problem. That's the one for me that really causes me an injury. So I do a lot of work on hoops, because most of the work that I do these days is teaching samples and kit designs.
Yeah.
So they tend to be on the smaller scale. And because I do that, I kind of manage my back problems and stuff with those quite well. But I do find the computer is a real problem.
Well, if you're sitting in a chair like that and sitting like that, it's going to be a problem. I don't care what you do.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. And when I'm stitching, I sit better. It's really noticeable. If I'm stitching, I sit up straighter. I put my feet on the floor. And, you know, I kind of have it under control. When I'm on the computer, it's like, I don't know. I don't know what the difference is, but I tuck my feet. They're like crossed over each other under my chair. I'm doing it as we speak. I'm sitting at my desk, looking at my computer screen. Goodness knows why. There's nothing on it. And I have my feet in this silly position. And I just think, what is wrong with me? But hey, what can you do?
All right. You need therapy. It's clear.
Yep. Clearly.
All right. You have on your site, you list all the techniques, and I'm sure they all come from work at the Royal School and then subsequent efforts. But you list them all, including ribbon work, and I'm intrigued by ribbon work.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you pick that up, and is that appreciably different from needle and thread?
Wow. That is a very good question, Gary.
Thank you.
So I picked up ribbon work because we had a wonderful tutor at the RSN called Shelley. And she basically snuck into our curriculum a single day of ribbon work.
Yeah.
Because she was like, how can you do this whole thing without having seen any ribbon work? Because at that point, I don't know, I guess it wasn't really a big thing at that point. Everyone thought it was kind of twee and it wasn't considered really that important. But Shelley was like, well, you know, we've got a bit of time. I think she was teaching us, I want to say it was quilting or beadwork or something, one of the topics that the RSN did with us that were relatively small, so we only got like a day or two on them, and plus like, you know, 3 or 4 days of homework.
Of course.
And so she kind of just snuck it in there, and I was like, this is really fun, and it's really pretty. I like ribbons. They're lovely to work with. They feel good. And they work really beautifully, and you almost can't go wrong, which is kind of nice, because a lot of the stuff that I do, you can go really wrong.
Yeah.
And it's nice to have something that, you know, almost whatever you do, it's just going to look nice. And it's a really good quick fix, too, compared to some of the techniques where it will take like a really long time to do a small thing. Ribbon work, you can build up relatively quickly. And so to the other part of your question about how is it appreciably different, in some ways it's not. So there are certain stitches that you use in ribbon work that you would use in normal surface embroidery. So like chain stitches and French knots, that kind of thing. And then there are the things that you make with ribbon. So roses are a really big one, which you kind of manipulate the ribbon in your hands with a tiny little needle and a piece of thread, and then you apply that to the fabric. So rather than actually stitching with the ribbon into the fabric in the first place, you're creating something separate and then sticking it on. And then there's the kind of in-betweeny ones where the stitch is changed because it's a ribbon. So there's one called ribbon stitch, pretty good example, where you lay the ribbon out flat and then you stitch down through the ribbon. So it's a thing that you couldn't really do with thread because it wouldn't really do anything. But with ribbon, it gives you this little sort of curly bit on the end, which is really cute. Yeah. So it's this kind of both, which is really fun.
So it sounds like then in the needlework world, that's really kind of an escape technique where you can just go off and do something different.
Yeah, and it's a relatively quick fix. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there's lots of things about it you could do it for ages and you could learn so much about it, but there's certain things where you could just kind of, you can make a flower that looks really good really fast.
Oh, okay.
So if you want something like 3D flowers, it's perfect because it's going to give you a lot of oomph. It's going to look really, really good, but you don't have to kind of spend ages and ages and ages and ages and ages doing it, which sometimes is just what you need.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I meant by escape. So it gives you a chance to do something really dimensional without doing stump work.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And it goes really well with stump work as well. So if you've done something with stump work, like you want to do something with needle lace, which is pretty slow. It's beautiful. And I love doing needle lace, but I don't do it very often because it's very slow. And it's one of those things that's quite hard to fit into like a day class kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And actually ribbon work can kind of work with that. So you can do something that's very involved, like needle lace, and then you can put ribbon work with it. And so you can get the kind of the background elements or the things around it without having to make the whole project a really long project.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of, yeah, that's quite nice as well. And yeah, that's, ribbon work's a bit of a favorite for me.
It's a technique that intrigues me.
Mm. Yeah, that's kind of how I was when we first did it. We did this little bit with Shelley and it really was a taster. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. We did a little... it's a little circlet thing. It was cute. I have it framed on my wall, actually. And it was one of the rare things that we did that was just pretty. We did lots of things that were interesting and, you know, dramatic and lots of other kind of things, but most of them weren't pretty. And this one, I was like, I kind of felt like it was a license to just do something pretty, which I really like. I like pretty pink things. Yep. Not that you can always tell it from my work, but I do. And I kind of was like, okay, so we've tried a few little bits and I went off and kind of delved a bit more into it once I was done with the apprenticeship, because that was quite late on in our apprenticeship anyway. And then, so I finished the apprenticeship and I was doing various things and I just was like, well, I'm really interested in ribbon work. I really enjoyed that. And we didn't spend much time on it. So I'm going to kind of go into it a bit more. And so I looked at loads of books and I tried things and I would try things and be like, oh, I don't like how those instructions do that. That doesn't seem like a way that is easy or works particularly well. So I would kind of go, okay, well, I know what I'm looking to get to. How am I going to get to that?
Mm-hmm.
And make it so that it's consistent. And because that's one of the things that the RSN is really big on. It's not necessarily about perfection. It's about consistency. Because
mm-hmm.
if you do the something that is consistent throughout, it will always look more perfect.
Yeah.
Because it's repeated. I was like, okay, well, how do I do some of these things in ribbon and actually make them so they can be consistent and repeatable and that people will find this easier to learn? And so that's why I started really doing the kits with it, so I could kind of experiment myself and find out little ways. So you probably would find that the way I do ribbon work in my kits isn't necessarily exactly the same as you would find in a book. So some of them will be, but the instructions might be a little different. And I've done that with some other things as well. I mean, lots of them are the same in technique-wise. And obviously everyone that writes about needlework will write slightly differently. You know, the words are different.
Right.
But there are certain things like a bullion knot. Bullion knots are a big thing. Now, I love them, but the first time I tried them, I went, never again. I'm just never doing a bullion knot. I'm never going to do anything that needs a bullion knot because they're horrible. And then I was like, no, okay, I've got to crack this. And so I sat down and kind of worked out things that you can do to make it a lot easier. I won't go into detail about it because I have to wave my hands around and you can't see me. I kind of have this method that I think just makes it so much easier to follow a book or not and make it a good one every time. And so that's what you find in my instructions. So the result is the same, and the method really is the same, but I've kind of broken it down so that it's easier to follow, and that if you've not done it before, you're still going to be able to get a nice, fairly consistent result. So yeah, this is something I love doing in embroidery, is like picking it apart and going, how can I make this more accessible and easier for people?
Yeah. See, that's the editorial function there. See?
Yep.
Exactly what you're doing. Yeah,
definitely.
All right. Now we're going to run out of time, and I want to talk about your new book, but I've got to, and I can't decide what to ask about, so I'm going to ask about both. You got to work on Kate Middleton's wedding gown, but then your own wedding gown ain't too shabby.
So, thank you.
So I'm just going to say, tell about both of those.
Okay, well, that's easy because they're the same technique.
Okay. Oh, okay, good.
So that's good. Kate Middleton's one, it's kind of a funny story behind me even doing any of it. But the first thing I'm going to tell you is that I really, really didn't work much on it because I was basically too busy at the time.
Oh.
So I did work on it. And the story of it is that, so I can't remember the dates exactly, but basically I was living somewhere away from home by this point, and I'd gone back to see mum for some reason. And I remember I was sitting there like having a cup of tea with my mum, and my phone rang, and I was like, my phone never rings. Why is my phone ringing? So I took this call, and it was the RSN, and it was Jill Holdsworth, who used to be one of the coordinators, basically, of all the different people working there. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, we've got this top secret project. And I kind of looked at my mum and I was thinking, okay, I'm just going to step outside for a minute. Okay, tell me about this top secret project. And she went, well, it's going to be done in the next few weeks. And, I can't tell you too much about it. We're getting everybody in if they're available. Do you want to come work on it? And I was kind of like, well, we know these two are getting married in a few months. And it was literally, it was maybe 4 months before the wedding that I got the call or something like that. It was not very long before.
Wow.
And so I kind of went, is it a wedding dress by any chance? And she kind of went, well, how did you know that? And I was like, well, I put two and two together and came up with four.
Yeah, not too hard. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, well, yeah, I'd love to, but I'm kind of, because they were talking about, the following week and for a few weeks after that, because obviously this wasn't going to happen right before the wedding, like in the last couple of days. This was happening a couple of months before, and there wasn't a lot of time in between. And I kind of went, well, I'm booked for this, 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 and this, and I can't just drop everything.
Right.
So yes, I'd love to, and I'm going to come and do a few hours, but that's probably all I'm going to be able to do. So I basically, when we actually kind of got to working on this, I just did a few bits of cutting out lace. But the really funny bit was going back to tell my mum, because obviously, like, my mum knows I never get phone calls. So right. She went, oh, who was that? And I went, you don't lie to your own mother. It's pretty tricky.
Right.
So I kind of went, it was Jill. And she was like, oh, why is Jill phoning you? and I was like, I'm not really supposed to tell you. And she went, are you going to be working on a wedding dress? And I was like, maybe. Yeah. Yes, there's no hiding stuff from your mother.
No,
and mine's pretty savvy. And it was not difficult to work out what was going on.
Right.
So it was kind of like, don't tell anyone, and we had to obviously sign paper to say we weren't going to tell anyone. Yeah, I was like, well, my mom kind of already figured it out, but never mind.
So was it was it a process of basically they were getting everyone that had the skill level together, all hands on deck, whatever hours you could put in, because we got to turn this thing quickly.
Yeah, because it was a super quick turnaround. And if I remember correctly, there was a bit of a delay on getting some of the lace because there were two different laces, I think. And one came from France and the other from somewhere else. And it might have been the UK, I'm not sure. But I think the one from France was delayed, or the main fabric might have been delayed. I can't remember. But anyway, it ended up being a faster process, I think, than even they anticipated. Mm-hmm. And so they had like rows of us. We were sat in front of our lovely big windows at the RSN. And it was kind of long tables with the big bolts of lace on the kind of the back of the table. So the bit furthest away from where you were sitting. And then in front of you was a little shoebox lined with tissue paper and all the rest of it. And you were basically assigned a particular flower or a sprig of leaves or a, you know, something, some kind of motif off of the lace. And it was find that and cut it out and put it in that box and just keep doing that. So they built up this bank of cardboard boxes full of this one particular sprig or flower or whatever it might be in each one. And so when they came then to assemble the design, they could just go, that's the bit I need, and they'd pick it from that box. And, you know, now I need that flower, and there it would be in the box. So it kind of meant that they could do it all very, I don't know, very slickly when it came to that point. But I didn't actually see any of that point because I was then back doing various other work.
Right. So basically, so basically they were taking very expensive lace and just destroying it to get the pieces.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah. But the final result was much, much more beautiful. So way, way more than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
Really, really gorgeous thing. And it was really worth it to get because the design that was made for the lace, you could never, well, I mean, if you'd just had the lace handmade completely, you could obviously achieve it by hand, creating it from scratch. But actually, the most sensible way to do it was to create this design out of existing lace. And that's actually what I did with my wedding dress too. So I got existing bits of panels of lace and individual lace motifs, and I sort of created a design and arranged them and chopped little bits up here and there, and then stitched them onto the I had a tulle layer on top of the skirt on the bodice. And then so it was me and Helen did a lot of work on it. She is one amazing friend. And then another friend of mine, Becky, who she's a stitch in quine on the internet. So you could probably find her on there. She did the Future Tutor program. She was one of the first to do that. So after I graduated, there was like a little interim period where there weren't any trainees. And then Becky was one of the first Future Tutors who came on.
Oh.
And so I met her, I want to say that was a knitting and stitching show or something similar to that. And it turned out we lived in the same place. So we kind of got together and did stitching stuff. And then I was like, well, you know, they're just going to start this program. Maybe you should apply for that. And yeah, so she did. And yeah, so she did a lot of helping on my wedding dress as well. And we were sewing all little crystals and pearls on until 11 p.m. the night before the wedding.
Oh, my. Oh,
I think Becky put the last stitch in at about 11 o'clock. And I was like, you know what? We're done. Like, I don't care if it falls off. We're done.
Well, I was going to ask you, the mental gymnastics that go into making your own wedding dress, and especially doing it at that level, at some point, do you just have to say enough is enough?
Yes.
Okay.
At 11 o'clock the night before the wedding.
Yeah. Obviously. Yeah. That would be a time. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's a whole other story that goes along with the timing of the wedding, but, I'd been making it for quite a while, and I had all the kind of, the structure was done quite early on, but I had to, well, anyone who's ever done the wedding dress thing will know about the fluctuating weight problem. It's, you see it on all the celebrities, they drop however many pounds right before the wedding, and it's no different for normal people. So I was kind of like, okay, well, like, I can't finish it until quite close to the wedding, because my weight was going up and down like a yo-yo. It does anyway. And so I had to make it fit. And it was like, okay, well, it has to fit before we can do the last bits of the embroidery. So, yeah. But I had it on a mannequin in my spare room for months. So my husband just wasn't allowed in there. Which I was like, basically, it's, I mean, it was covered in a sheet. But I was like, yeah, you can't go in there. And no, you still can't go in there. Nope. For months. But yeah. Yeah, it was good fun, and I wouldn't do it again.
No, I'm sure not. Yeah. Yeah.
It was an amazing thing to do, and I'm glad I had the time to put into it, and I'm so grateful for the help that I had with it from Helen and Becky, because I could not have done it without them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a big task, and I would never do one for anyone else. So nobody else.
I'm sure one of those will cure you. Yes. Yeah. Enough of that. Yep.
Enough. Yep. Yep.
All right. Now we're running out of time. I knew this was going to happen. So we have a new book.
Yes.
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 So you did, yeah, so you did white work while you were doing your apprenticeship program. And now this one is.
Actually, it was, I didn't write it during my apprenticeship. Thank goodness. It was pretty much right afterwards. It came out in 2012. So I had a couple of years in between.
Okay.
And then, yeah, so this one is gold work. And I actually first got the commission to do this in 2014. So it has taken me, yeah, I know, it's taken me 5 years, which they, Crowood, have been so incredibly patient about this, because basically, like, everything in my life has flipped upside down since this. So I got married, and we've had bereavements, and I've had a child. But pretty much everything that could have changed has changed, apart from I'm still doing embroidery. So, yeah, they've kind of had to put up with the ups and downs of all of that. But it's been kind of a constant in my life, which has been quite nice. And it's been great and really hard work.
Yeah, yeah, putting books together, not a simple thing, no.
No, it's not. It's not. And I am a complete control freak, which is not unusual for an embroiderer, but there it is. I am one. And I kind of was like, I don't know how to make a book without making the whole book. Mm. So they, and you'll know about this, you kind of just ask people to write the thing and provide you with the images, and you'll do the rest. Mm-hmm. And so the publishers were like, give us the text, give us the images, we'll lay it out. You know, that's our thing.
Right.
And I was like, well, yep, except I can't quite handle that. And I found it, actually, it was a very different process. There's different publishers, again, I'm sure you'll know about this, but they work in very different ways. So I worked with Search Press on my white work book, and they have a very different working method to Crowood, who did the gold work book. And so I found it a real struggle to visualize what the book would look like if I didn't lay it out.
Oh.
So I pretty much had to lay it out all myself, like I was doing kit instructions,
right,
in order to actually get to grips with what I needed to put in and how to lay it out to make it flow properly. Mm-hmm. Because the last thing I wanted was for there to be, you know, that, so most pages have, it's a layout of like 9 blocks on there. And if there were the wrong number, so if there were 10, one of them would spill onto the next page.
Mm-hmm.
And as a reader of embroidery books and other, you know, instructional stuff, I find that really difficult and really annoying.
Right.
So I was like, no, I need to lay it out. I need to know where stuff is going so that I can make sure that everything that's to do with one instruction will fit on one page.
Mm-hmm.
So, and pretty much it's actually worked out really well. I'm pleased, but I did a lot more work than I think anyone would have anticipated, including myself. But I'm pleased with the end result. I'm sitting here looking at it now and I'm like, yeah, actually, I'm glad I did all of that extra work. It really, for me, it really paid off because it meant that I could do the book that I wanted to do.
It's rare that extra work doesn't pay off. So,
yeah, that's kind of what I figured when I was like right in the middle of this. I was like, I'm pretty sure this is going to pay off. Hard work is a good thing,
right,
you know.
Right. Keep telling yourself,
And everyone else is going just write the damn thing.
So what? So describe the book. Is it a project book, a how-to book, a combination?
It's a combination. So I'm going to look at it right now so I can tell you accurately because now I've written it, it's completely out of my head. So it starts with like a history and then you've pretty much got a breakdown of everything that you need. So there's a bunch of stuff on the materials and equipment that you would want. There's stuff on the fabrics, obviously the gold threads, it's kind of important. Needles and beeswax and design equipment. And then there is a whole nice chapter on design, which is quite specific for gold work. So you can start with anything. And you know, if you've got a design, you can probably adapt that for gold work. But the way that you take it from, like, here's a picture or, you know, an outline drawing or something like that, the way that you take it from that to actually being a piece of gold work is quite a process.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of takes you through all of that, talks about different types of padding and the heights of them and how shiny things are. So I have this like scale in the book that goes basically from most shiny to least shiny, because they're kind of shiny. And what that does is to help you figure out whereabouts in your design to place the different techniques and the different threads, because there are so many.
Mm-hmm.
And so that should be kind of a helpful, like a visual guide as to how that works. And then you kind of go into getting ready to do your embroidery. So it's the transferring stuff, how you set up your stitching environment. And I've got a bit that I'm quite pleased with, which is I've titled, How Much Gold Do I Need? Which for anyone who's kind of dabbled in gold work, maybe done a kit or something like that, you could quite easily just not have a clue. And you know, you can order these things, I get the gold threads wholesale, but they come by weight and a lot of places will sell them by weight, which is, I say a lot of places, there's like three, but generally they're, you know, they're originally sold by weight, and it's quite tricky sometimes to do that. So I do them now by length, because the length is something you can actually calculate. And so I've put the calculations in there. So how I work out how much of something I'm going to need. And some of it's kind of basic when you know, but if you didn't know, you might look at it and go, well, where do I start?
Right.
So I'm kind of pleased with that a little bit. It's only like a page, but it's quite important. Mm-hmm. And then there's all the, so it goes from padding and then couching, and then you've got your chipping and cut work, and a bunch of other techniques as well, which are kind of fun. So there's kid leather and spangles and plate's really nice. I love plate. And then I put in some additional techniques as well, because a lot of the time when you're doing gold work, you might want to bring in some color. So I've put in a bit of applique and how to do satin stitch and basic silk shading. And then from there, it goes into projects. So there are six projects in here, and they kind of go from pretty much introductory level to like a quite advanced level.
Mm-hmm.
What I want people to be able to do with this book is to dip into it where they need to. So, you know, they need to know how to do plate, for example, and broad plate, which is a really like shiny, it's lovely stuff. It's actually on the cover, the the back of the dragon, the sort of spine part, his plate. And so if you think, okay, I want to know how to do that, right? I can dip in and I can look for the specific instruction on that. And it's also just kind of got all those things around what you do. And then there's actually a section after the project on how to finish off your embroidery. So I've done finishing in a hoop, which is something I love to do because it looks kind of nice, but also it harks back to how you've actually done it, which I kind of like. And then there's mounting on board, which is the kind of really traditional way. And then I did a little bit as jewelry because that's something I like to do. Quite like to make goldwork jewelry, and it really lends itself because you get that kind of 3D thing and it's blingy and sparkly and lovely.
Great.
So finishing it as jewelry is quite fun. So I stuck that in there as well.
of all the techniques that you do, why do you choose gold work to do a book on?
Oh, that is a good question. It's one of those that it's quite, no, that's wrong. It can be quite an involved technique. And a lot of the time when I'm stitching, because, you know, the reason that I'm stitching most of the time is to teach other people, I don't very often get to do the really involved stuff. I just don't have time. And when I'm busy doing all the stuff that's kind of the, not necessarily introductory level, but the kind of achievable in a certain time frame level, I don't get to really get my teeth into much. And Goldwork's one of those that I just really wanted an opportunity to really get my teeth into it and do something big. And so, although there are more out in this series before mine, it was actually the second one to be commissioned, I think, or the third. And so, because I've been working on it so long. and so I basically got to choose. Because we sort of said, okay, well, we want to do some books on embroidery. We don't necessarily know which techniques. We'd like you to write one. What would you like to write? And I went, and it was actually quite a hard question because I would have loved to write one on silk shading. But one of my wonderful colleagues wrote one on silk shading that is fabulous. And she's like the goddess of silk shading. So, yeah, quite glad that she did that one. it was kind of between silk shading and gold work. And I think at the time, because it was the beginning of the series as well, gold work kind of made sense because silk shading's quite a big undertaking and it's not necessarily the thing that a beginner would want to do. And I think because we were beginning the series, it was like, well, what's a thing that makes people go, ooh, and maybe I could do that. Goldwork won.
Well, it certainly is eye-catching when done well. Yes. Yeah, it's a technique to me that when done well, yeah, your jaw drops, and then when done poorly, no, not that. It just seems like there is an in between, but for me, it's just one or the other. Yeah,
I know what you mean. I know what you mean, but I have a very, I don't know, it's a learning outlook on embroidery in general, but gold work, I suppose, is a really good example of it, that you kind of, sometimes you have to get it wrong before you get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an enormous amount of value in the ones that don't look so great. it's not necessarily, you know, in the immediate visual, but, you know, the person that stitched that has learned so much by doing it that it has huge value, far beyond what it might appear. I'm always saying to students, like, I don't really believe in unpicking. I do unpick, obviously I do, we all unpick sometimes, but I kind of, I say leave it and learn from it. When you make a mistake, because more often than not, particularly if you're working through something like a kit and you're doing it for the learning, which a lot of the time people are, it's of more value to you and sometimes more value to other people as well to actually keep the mistake, because then you know, you know, you can see what you need to do differently next time. And sometimes remembering it just isn't enough, especially, you know, if you're, well, you'll know about this too, that you don't always go back to things all that fast.
No.
So, you know, there might be quite a time period between doing the one and then, you know, the next time you come to do that technique. And so actually keeping it, you know, mistakes and all. I don't know. I also kind of, you know, it's what makes us human, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, gold work is definitely on my short horizon. But
I think give it a go.
I know. And I have.
I have. People tell you this now, Gary. You need to give it a go.
Yeah. I have one little kit. And I don't know. I just think it's going to be so embarrassing when I get done that I'm going to just throw it in the trash. But
I doubt it. I don't know. Maybe I could send you a kit. I've got a few. A few enter level kind of ones that could be good for you.
Okay.
You might enjoy it.
Okay. Well, I'm sure I would. I'm sure I would. Yeah. It looks like a fun challenge. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite, I don't know. I always think Goldberg looks so different from other things.
Oh, yes.
But actually,
yes.
There's a lot of things that are the same. You know, you think of cut work, for example, and a lot of people go, cut work. Oh my God, it's so difficult. Like, well, I mean, I'm not going to say it's easy, it's challenging, but it's basically satin stitch.
Right.
And if you think of it as satin stitch, then it's not so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, so, no, it's not. Once you do it, it's not bad at all, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty much. You just kind of have to give it a go.
Right.
And I'm a big fan of actually sampling things. So a lot of the time I have students at home. So people come to my studio and we do various different things. And a lot of the time people don't feel that confident. And maybe, you know, the big project they're doing, they want to give to someone, or, you know, it's an important project for them. And so they don't want to make those mistakes on there. And I kind of go, okay, well, that's fine. That doesn't bother me. What we'll do is we'll step back from that and we will sample.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get out, you know, a bit of cheap calico on a frame, and we will have a go at that stitch. And gold work, it can really help to do that,
mm-hmm.
because the it just feels very different. You know, you've got all these threads. You don't necessarily know what they're going to look like next to each other until you've had a go. And so it's the same for anything, really, but gold work's just the most obvious example, where it's a really good idea to just try it, you know, where it doesn't matter. And kits can be great for that, because kits are a really good learning tool. So you might want to use it for something afterwards. You might want to put it on the wall or give it to someone or whatever. But, you know, it's not, it's kind of at that level where it's not going to completely break the bank.
Right.
And it's also not going to take you so many hours that you're going to be really upset, you know, if it turns out not perfect.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's a good way to do a sample if you're not confident to sort out your own sampling and just kind of have a go on a random scrap. A kit can be a really good way of doing that.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'll have to give it a run.
Yep. You really do. I'm going to keep tuning in.
Okay.
And like send you a prompt every now and again. Gary, have you tried gold work yet?
Okay. Maybe that's exactly what I need. Yes. Right there. Yep. Lizzie, this has been...
We'll talk again in a few months, and I'll check up on you.
Yeah, yeah. Lizzie, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been lovely.
Yeah, really enjoyed the conversation, and good luck with your book. Hope it's a huge success for you. And
I hope it will be.
Yes.
I hope people enjoy it. That's the main thing.
Yep.
And it helps people learn.
Yep, and thanks to everyone for listening.